Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today, Bob Hoban and myself are talking about psychedelics and the state of cannabis in France, and we are joined by the founder and CEO of MCAN, Sarah Velimirovich. Sarah, thank you for being here with us today.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me.
Sarah, welcome to the show. It's good to have you on this evening. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about different topics over the course of our 100 plus episodes. So we're really lucky to have you because we really haven't dived too deeply into the topic of psychedelics. So first of all, before we even get into that, talk a little bit about what brought your particular interest to the world of psychedelics.
Sure. To the world of psychedelic, I would say that I came in straight from the drug policy reform camp. So it was back in 2015 when I did an exchange here in the United States that I discovered this whole world and kind of organizations and so many people working on changing drug policy from, you know, a criminal justice point of view to public health point of view. And that's when I discovered Students of Sensible Drug Policy, and I started interning for them, and then later kind of went into representing the youth voice at the United Nations, sorry about that. And then also on the board, but what really brought me into the psychedelics, I think, is apart from the kind of professional argument that you can say, which is psychedelics really have a tremendously robust scientific evidence behind them. What really convinced me is trying them and just seeing the magic firsthand, to be honest.
So Sarah, where did you study in the U.S. During that program?
Yeah, sure. So I studied at Rutgers for a year, but I studied the majority of studies were in France at Sciences Po.
Excellent.
Where I studied.
I'm a Rutgers grad myself. So it's what did you think of your time in New Brunswick?
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, I was in New Brunswick. I loved it. It was so amazing. It was a great, it was just a typical American university experience. It was so awesome. And I remember my first day I arrived, and I had, a big suitcase. And I remember I was worried. I came from the Amtrak, I guess, and came to the station. I was worried that if I was going to find the school, you know, if I was going to find Rutgers in New Brunswick. But then you arrive and you realize, well, New Brunswick is Rutgers. It's all the same thing. It's like a completely student town. And of course, coming from Europe, I was raised in Serbia and then studying in France. You just don't have that. We don't have the same type of, you know, university complexes that way. But awesome. So what did you studied law at Rutgers?
No, I did my undergraduate at Rutgers. So I had a double major. I majored in administration of justice, which is kind of like a pre-law program in political science. And then ultimately did move on to law school in the Western United States. But, you know, it's funny, though, when you say, I wonder if I could find Rutgers, because a lot of people don't know this, but Rutgers is one of the largest universities in the entire United States. It's got an undergraduate population that it's well over 55,000. I mean, it's a huge, huge school. Mm. And there's New Brunswick, which is a fairly large city by many standards. And then the neighboring towns of Piscataway, and a couple of other nearby towns make up multiple campuses for Rutgers. And these are things that a lot of people don't even know about Rutgers University. But no, it's very, very, very proud to share that with you. But, you know, as you dove into studying the drug reform elements of society, and this is something that really is at the core. I always like to say, what happens when a movement becomes an industry. And that's kind of what we're witnessing in real time with the cannabis industry, because it wasn't an industry. And frankly, most places that seek to enact some sort of cannabis or marijuana reform don't really seek to create an industry so much as they seek to affect some sort of policy change, which usually affects criminal justice, right? So then when you sort of start to go down that road and you look at psychedelics and the usefulness of psychedelics, talk a little bit about what you've seen in real time and what kind of movement you've seen to recognize the viable therapeutic benefits of psychedelics.
Yeah, definitely. So it's just the interest in the past year has been incredible. I suspect that it has something to do with the kind of how cannabis kind of really went global in a really robust, powerful way since 2016, and also definitely since 2018 and Canadian legalization that really kind of brought cannabis as a serious policy option, at least for medical cannabis. And then of course, we're not still talking about recreational here in Europe, but really brought it as a serious option here in Europe, and I suspect that the kind of the newly opened policy circles, kind of the way that they're open to cannabis, it's an interesting it's an interesting thing that's happening with psychedelics now too. Of course, in psychedelics, it's a very big emphasis, just because of how very different they are from cannabis as substances. So usually we kind of think of cannabis as something that can both be a medicine but also a nutraceutical product, or can be used kind of more or less frequently, whereas psychedelics are really not like that. They're kind of a therapy or a treatment type of substance where they're really best. The best results really come out of a carefully guided and carefully kind of administered setting or a careful clinical protocol, right? So in that sense, psychedelics, the way that we're discussing them now, at least in business spaces, is kind of very under the framework of our pharmaceutical applications and kind of the very medical clinical way to introduce them to a larger population. Then again, of course, there's a big movement in the United States in for a decriminalizing nature. So in a sense, also addressing the criminal justice part, as well as kind of following this principle of like, okay, well, let's just laissez faire, right? Like let's just take our hands off the people who are using these substances for their personal use and are not endangering anyone publicly. And then of course, one of I would say the most interesting initiatives is the IP34, I guess, in Oregon, that we're also excited to see what happens with. That would effectively, within 2 years' time, and if it passes, would effectively institute a therapy program for psilocybin mushrooms.
Yes, and we're very interested in kind of watching how that develops here, because I believe that is on the ballot in Oregon coming up in the next month. But as we look specifically at Europe, I want to post something to you, Bob, because as Sarah was speaking, it reminded me of something that we've talked about before, which is that the emphasis for cannabis in Europe has always been more medical than recreational, as we've kind of seen here in the United States. And so, obviously, Sarah, you do a lot of work with MCAN, which we understand is policy work and advising. in Europe. But Bob, I just want to put to you really quickly, do you see that because there is more of that medical focus in cannabis, that that may somehow also apply to psychedelics like psilocybin in the European Union in a different way than we're seeing it here in Oregon or the United States? Oregon is an example with that ballot initiative in November.
Well, it's interesting. It's a really good point. Good question. In the United States, I'm surprised, frankly, the advancement and the recognition that psychedelics have so quickly gotten, not to question even for a minute any of the therapeutic benefits. That's not my job. My point, though, is I'm surprised how fast certain circles, medicinal circles, physicians, researchers, how quickly they've embraced psychedelics in the United States. And it seems like there are more distinct and available pathways for research and development here in the U.S. But there's also kind of two tracks going on in the U.S. There's the decriminalization movement, which we've talked about in a lot of places, Colorado being one of those, Oregon, so forth and so on, various cities across California. And then there's the pursuit of basically formulas and clinical-like trials surrounding psychedelics. We haven't seen that vigor around cannabis as a whole from the scientific community in the U.S. It's increasing week by week, day by day, but we haven't seen that vigor. Now, if you look across the pond, it does seem that there is more of a focus on looking at a subject and seeing, is there something therapeutic? Is there a medicinal benefit here? And if there is, here's the pathway for you to go and establish that. That just appears as an outsider as to sort of how things have evolved. What do you think of that characterization, Sarah, about that perception? Is that really what's happening? Is there more of a chance that the European Union or various countries within the EU take major steps forward with psychedelics? Or are there more traps than meets the eye?
Yeah, so I would say that I definitely agree with your characterization, and it's such an honor to speak to you, Bob. But yeah, so I really agree with kind of, yeah, like the how surprising it is that how fast that some of these communities have embraced psychedelics. And I would say that in the United States, at least a part of it, I think, has to do with, because, you know, in the United States, you already have companies, like you say, that are, you know, a pharma company that are, you know, either formulating products or have some products in the pipeline, in the FDA approval process, and so on. This is obviously all kind of in the context of, you know, MDMA for, you know, psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD being most probably in kind of generally approved by the FDA by 2022, and then psilocybin also being granted a breakthrough therapy status. So that's the context. But I would say that a lot of it has to do, the way that we see it from here in Europe, is also with Canada and how Canada is kind of doing its own activism in the policy realm. Because it was Canada in 2018 that when they legalized that, you know, medical cannabis became a serious and very powerful discussion in Europe. And that's simply because of, you know, the capital markets opening in Canada for the space, right? And then now in the last year, we've seen the Ministry of Health kind of granting or, you know, making statements that kind of seem favorable to granting Canada health licenses to operate psychedelics, which means that it's in that very important sense, it's opening the way for psychedelics globally, or at least in North America, you know, Israel and Germany and a couple of countries in Europe. But I would definitely not say that Europe is not ready for psychedelics at this time. we're having trouble. We're having trouble with medical cannabis even. So I mean, you know, it's been a good 2 years for medical cannabis in Europe, definitely. But we're definitely not there yet in terms of psychedelics. It's like I said at the beginning, it's definitely helped open the way, and you know, people are more ready to listen. And maybe it's also the effect of Corona and the way that people are, you know, changing their opinions and changing their minds on things that they usually don't change as fast or as much. But yeah.
Well, let's talk about medical cannabis, and specifically in France, because we know that recently there has been a development. So will you share that with us and kind of tell us what the significance of that development is?
Yeah, for sure. So 1 week ago, the French government published a decree for medical cannabis experimentation, making it effectively a reality. So we're on. It's happening. This has been an experimentation that's been 2 years in the making. You know, various different committees and the Ministry of Health have looked into the question, and most likely in March 2021, they're going to start a very limited in number experiment of giving medical cannabis to 3,000 patients for five conditions. They include MS, refractory pain, palliative care, cancer, and epilepsy. So, and what they did, the committee that created this, is they were really, adamant in creating a very limited experiment that is going to be set up for success. They wanted to make sure they only picked the conditions or the diseases that they knew that there's robust evidence for abroad. And the point of this is really to create a success story that will then lead them to have a national medical cannabis regulation expected in 2022-23. So that's the big news. So France is on board.
So do you anticipate that ultimately does create some sort of commercial model, or you start slowly by looking at the therapeutic benefits and making it available to patients within particular categories?
So, yes, this is an important aspect. So what is definitely going to happen is that 3,000 patients are going to get medical cannabis in the next 2 years during the period of a year or year and a half. Commercially, like we've seen in many countries in Europe, for the first 2 to 5 years, when a market opens up, for example, Germany, there's no other way than to get the medical cannabis from abroad, because that's the only cannabis that, you know, exists that is, you know, EU GMP approved and kind of meets the pharmaceutical standards that you need to have any other medication meet in order for it to be received, prescribed by doctors and received by patients. So in that sense, the way that the French government is likely structuring it right now is that they're going to seek out from abroad medical cannabis for free to be given to these patients, and then they're going to engage in some form of government guided tenders during the first couple of years, while simultaneously working on setting up and making operational the French production. The French are known for their protectionism and the way that they are kind of really proud of their national treasures. and so we'll see how that plays out. What's also interesting about France in terms of cannabis is that it's really a country that, in terms of hemp, in terms of industrial hemp, is really has a very, very rich, very interesting history. So it's actually a number one producer in Europe of hemp, and a fourth or fifth producer in the world. of industrial hemp.
Yes. And, we were actually just talking about that the other day in terms of just the number. Do you know what the sixth, this is a trivia question for you. What's the sixth largest producer of hemp in the world? If you get this, you'll never get it. It's
USA?
No. Well, the USA is number three. France is number four. Chile is number five. Number six is North Korea.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
Wow.
I had no idea. Well, let me ask you this, Sarah. What took so long? France is perceived by so many to be such a progressive country in so many different ways. And like you said about hemp, it's got a history with this plant. So what took so long for France to sort of get on board with this notion that cannabis does, in fact, deserve treatment the way we're describing this program?
Yeah, so I think that it was really interesting to be there when it happened. I would say the most, it was kind of like swept away by the wave of medical cannabis, and I would say summer of 2019. And it was really also when the UK kind of had this campaign with Billy Caldwell and you know, this boy who had to receive CBD for epilepsy, and it was really, you know, a story of, you know, life and death, and then kind of a lot of big media got together and kind of got really loud about it, that the UK Home Secretary, you know, allowed kind of basically cannabis for medical purposes. And then France also very quickly just completely, you could see there were conference events, and you could see a lot of movement and a lot of people discussing and talking about this seriously in a way that they hadn't before. And I would say that your question is definitely justified, Bob, that when you say, you know, what took so long, but, you know, France is actually a huge paradox when it comes to cannabis. In a sense that while it actually has the highest consumption of cannabis, you know, for recreational purposes in Europe, so it has 17 million users. This is 1/4 of the population, and it has 5 million daily users of cannabis. At that same time, it has one of the most intensive and most restrictive criminal justice policies in cannabis in Europe. Of course, Europe is, as a whole, is quite liberal, so you wouldn't feel it, and no one compares to the United States. I mean that in a not so kind way, but forgive me. But it's really challenging to kind of hold these two truths together at the same time. So just to paint a picture from quite recently. So like I said, the last week the French government issued a decree saying we're going forward with the medical cannabis experimentation. And then at the same time, the newly appointed Minister of Interior for France said, kind of started off on this campaign that you can see it's going to last. He's the type of person who's, you know, kind of like a zero tolerance policy type of Minister of Interior. And he said that cannabis is shit. Excuse my French, but you know, he kind of really you know, started off on this inflammatory campaign against cannabis, and kind of really, you know, making sure that you know, police is approaching this issue one way, whereas on the other hand, you have a huge portion of the population who is, you know, very, you know, intimately connected with cannabis in a very frequent way. So it's a real show here in France.
And perhaps the answer to this question is very obvious, and if it is, I apologize. But what form is the medical cannabis in that the French government is allowing? When you said it, At first, I thought that I knew what it would be, but I imagine it's not smokable flower. So is it a formulation of a high THC oil? And then you said that they would be likely looking outward to source that. And since it is for a medical use, I'm just interested in what companies or what kind of company they would look to source that from. I mean, is it like an Epidiolex or is it something else?
Yeah, sure. So just to quickly answer your questions, in one of the documents that they put out, they put out like a five different ratios that the medication is going to have. So for example, 1-to-1 CBD THC, or I don't know, like 5-to-1 CBD THC, and so on. So they gave like a set of five of these ratios that they want to test. And then for smokable, it's something that they particularly kind of emphasize is that smoking will not be the form that's recommended, obviously because the combustion itself, so burning the actual cannabis and other stuff that is inside is unhealthy for the throat. So in terms of, you know, the body, the committee made up of mostly doctors who have made these recommendations, they obviously said, you know, it's going to be oils, it's going to be topicals, it's going to be flower, but with vaping, with vaporizers, but not combustion. Yeah. And then where would they be sourcing it? So, like I said, mostly from international companies, be this, you know, Canadian companies or, you know, companies in the United States, companies operating in Latin America, it's in Europe as well, like you said. I think that this will become clear probably around by the end of the year. Like I said, the experimentation is set to begin the 31st of March next year. So by then they will have to have figured it out.
Well, it's a extremely interesting development, and I'm glad to have you on to learn more about it, and definitely something that we'll follow on the Hoban Minute. I believe that there is a SciTech event coming up this month. Where can we hear you in the near future? What's on the horizon for you, Sarah?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks so much for that plug, Eric. So I'm super excited to tell you about the SciTech Summit. It's on October 27th, and it's a premier event in psychedelic space for this wave of commercialization and kind of accelerating business in the space of psychedelics, as well as of course doing good. So some of the speakers we have is Rick Doblin, Christian Angermeyer, Bia Labate, Dr. Rosalind Watts, Matthew Johnson from Johns Hopkins, and then also a lot of other speakers that, you know, are not as suitable for name dropping, but are really, really cool. And it's going to be a 1-day event virtually, and it's free to access. So if you got a computer and you got internet, you're good to go. So go ahead and register at scitech.biz, and there you'll find all the details about the summit. It's going to be really awesome. We're hoping to really help as a platform bring psychedelics to the mainstream, to as many people. So in a sense, like I said, the event is free at scitech.biz, and it's, we've really made it so that it's kind of a public education type of thing, and it's kind of also psychedelic business 101. So in that sense, it's going to be super fun. And if you're looking to discover more about psychedelics or business, that's where you'll find some clues. SciTech.biz.
Well, we will definitely tune in, and it has been an absolute joy to have you with us today on the Hoban Minute. Thank you for staying up late, and we will come back and have you on again soon to learn more about all of the interesting things that are happening with psychedelics and cannabis in the European Union. Have a great day, Sarah.
Awesome. Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.